Welcome to Book Waves. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is A.M. Holmes, whose latest novel is May We Be Forgiven. Earlier novels include This Book Will Save Your Life, The End of Alice, The Safety of Objects, a memoir, The Mistress's Daughter. Depending upon how you look at it, there are either 9 or 10 books, because there's a book in there called Appendix A. This latest book, you took 7 years to write. Curiously, though, 5 years ago, the memoir came out, so I'm just curious about the timeline. Were you working on May We Be Forgiven and the memoir simultaneously?
You know, there's a funny lag time because you turn the book in and it usually takes about a year to go through production. So I had already started working on this as that was going into production and all that. So not so much at the same time, although there definitely is a process, a little bit of overlap where I'm sort of beginning to kind of flesh out an idea, and I take a lot of notes because I like to have some sense of what I'm even thinking about before I just jump in there.
To that degree, does writing a memoir like that, does that influence at least the early writing of a novel?
The only way I think for me that it influences is an incredible sense of relief, because if I'm writing a piece of nonfiction like a memoir, I'm very, very aware of the difference between fact and fiction. And I think the whole sort of what I would call the James Frey debacle or episode really made me very sort of sharp in that sense. And so to finish the memoir and get to go back to writing fiction, I felt incredibly liberated and like I could just have a good time and make things up and, you know, dive deep.
Did the James Frey thing scare you in terms of the memoir?
No, it didn't scare me. I mean, I think because I have written fiction and nonfiction, I'm very, very aware of the difference between fact and the difference between something that is an act of the imagination. And I actually found that sort of debacle, in a way, insulting as a writer, and the idea that he somehow couldn't remember what really had happened and not. And we're talking about some pretty significant things like root canal. I mean, you know if you had a root canal or you didn't have a root canal. That's a simple one. But I think it made me want to be somewhat vigilant in the telling of the story in the memoir so that when I was writing something that had any imagining to it, I literally would say, I imagine that, blah, blah, blah. And in a novel, for me, I mean, I really am a fiction writer, and I work from my imagination. My novels are not told, thinly veiled versions of real life. So I just was aware of it. And I think the public is actually very confused because they'll say to me, oh, you wrote a new novel. Is it all true? I'm thinking, no, it's all one big lie.
For me, as an interviewer, when I read nonfiction now, it used to be I would assume, particularly memoir, I would assume, okay, this happened. And now, no matter what I'm reading, there is always that little piece in back of my mind saying, are you Jonah Lehrer? Are you James Frey? And it changes.
I think that's a problem. And I actually would ask people that question and sort of see if they suddenly go pale or, you know, what happens.
Well, I did ask, but that's I don't ask in that way. But when I was reading Catherine Boo, you know, that definitely did come up because of the way she writes.
Right.
But it's the New Yorker, and, you know, the New Yorker has fact checks up the wazoo.
Yeah.
A.M. Holmes, let's talk about May We Be Forgiven. You gave an interview in which you said that the origins of the novel came about because you were approached by Zadie Smith to write a short story, and you began writing it, and the story grew. That original story, the original premise, concerned two brothers. At what point did you get the idea of the two siblings in terms of where Zadie came in?
Mm-hmm. Well, the notion of the two siblings going at it predates Zadie slightly in that in the last novel, This Book Will Save Your Life, there's the beginnings of a thread of a relationship between two brothers, and I really didn't get to dive as deep into that as I wanted to. And then I wrote a short story called Brother on Sunday for the painter Eric Fischel for a book of his, and that also ran in The New Yorker. So I was thinking about it. I'd always been sort of interested in John Cheever's relationship with his brother Fred that Cheever wrote about in a book called Falconer, where he actually writes about a man who commits fratricide, kills his brother, and goes to jail. And he also wrote a short story called Goodbye, My Brother. So the threads were percolating. And when Zadie came to me, she said, I want you to write a piece that's about characters. And I was thinking, well, what kind of characters could generate an intense story very quickly? And I thought, well, the two brothers. So I started that thinking, again, it would be a part of my way of finding my way into something ultimately. And then I was just typing and typing and typing. And the deadline for Zadie's anthology came and went, and I gave him something I'd written long ago. And then I finished enough of this And I thought that was going to be it. It was a short story, and it ran in Granta's 100th issue. Salman Rushdie picked it for Best American Stories. And I was already still writing more, and I kept thinking, what are you doing? I have these conversations to myself. Why are you still writing it? It's finished. It's published. And it clearly was only the very beginning of a much, much more complex story.
At what point in the story does the short story end?
That's a very good question. It ends, well, I can't give away the exact moment because it's a key pivotal moment in the book, but it ends after the tragic intersection of George, Harry, and George's wife, Jane.
The aftermath of that tragic incident is not in the short story at
no,
all.
No, no. The interesting thing, too, is like, and I'll give one little sort of clunk. So George clonks Jane on the head with a lamp, which is very serious. But that happens, you know, 20 pages in. And the real question is, if you basically hit someone on the head in a lamp, you know, 20 pages into a book, where do you go from there? Which is why it was supposed to be a short story.
Harry's voice, the brother first person telling the story, it sounds to me from what you're saying is that Harry's voice, which is, best way to put it, it's he has no filters in what he says or does. Did that voice was that just suddenly there?
Kind of. I mean, you know, I think of writing anything, whether it's fiction, nonfiction, as almost like writing a piece of music, and you have to hit the pitch correctly. And part of that very beginning of something is finding sort of what those first sounds will be. And I think that that helps guide you through the rest of it, whatever it is. But it really is like a musical construction. And so, yes, Harry's voice was there. The interesting thing about Harry was that early on I felt somewhat frustrated by him. I kept thinking, why is this so frustrating to me to write? And I realized that part of it was I was writing about a person who didn't know himself. And it's very hard as a writer to have a main character who doesn't understand himself very well. So it was only as Harry actually began to unfold and to come to know who he was that I, as a writer, got to go sort of further into Harry. And then it got to be a lot of fun and really, you know, kind of an exciting ride.
Did you have to go back and rewrite those original pages at that point?
Not really. There's always sort of about 6 months or so of going back at the end of the last draft, and I'm always revising as I'm writing, but you're kind of going back and tuning things a little bit because there'll be little threads of things that you need to kind of make sure are planted earlier on or little, you know, little bits and pieces. But no, it was there from the start.
In reading some of your interviews about the book and reading the book, I'm seeing a small contradiction that may not be, which is that you talk in your interviews about the various themes of the book, which we'll go into, and why you decided to, for example, take scenes in South Africa. And yet at the same time, you also kind of say that it's unfolding as if you're watching it. So how is it unfolding and at the same time you're doing these things?
Well, I think that's the kind of the super cool thing, actually, about writing fiction. And it is a little bit, I mean, I describe it sometimes like time travel. You know, you create these characters that didn't exist before. For me, they become very real people. They become three-dimensional. And I think if you do what my teacher, Grace Paley, the writer, talked about, which is you think about the truth according to the character, as they begin to unfold and the story rolls out, they do things and go places that are not necessarily where you would expect them to go. And that's the great adventure of it as a writer.
Well, when you say expect, what do you mean?
Well, you know, the character of Harry, I mean, in many ways, I thought that Harry would probably meet a bad end when I started. And then as the story progressed, much to my very pleasant surprise, a couple of things happened. These two characters, two children, Ashley and Nate, sort of evolved as kind of wonderful kids and kind of much more complicated than they started off as. And I would say in some ways I didn't exactly see that coming, but I was very pleased by it. And Harry, there's not a specific moment, but just in the course of it, and it's a fairly long book, I really thought at some point he could end up just like a homeless person on the street. And I remember thinking a lot about what would it take for him and what is his evolution to not have that happen. And that goes back to a larger sort of idea for me, which is I think a lot about how do we write optimistically when we're living in a time that's not inherently optimistic. I guess, you know, intellectually and artistically for me, there is that kind of, and it's not meant as a contradiction, but that struggle of thinking of like, how do you discover or try to push towards these things in a story, but at a certain point, these are very real people to me, and it's got to be genuine and organic for them, because otherwise it really won't work.
You're a puppet master. Yeah.
Yeah.
So if you're avoiding being a puppet master and you're guiding them, I mean, on some level, you have to say, in a way, to Harry, hey, we're going to South Africa, but it has to be done in a way so that it's Harry's idea, not A.M. Holmes.
Right. Yes. I think that's true. I'd never been to South Africa before.
And you went for this?
I didn't go. I did enormous amounts of research.
What struck me in reading the book is that for the first 150 pages, it's a very, very black comedy. And, you know, people have said you don't laugh out loud in reading books. But I was laughing out loud at points. There's a certain point where it changes from being a tragic comedy, a very dark one but very funny one, into a novel of redemption. Was there a point where you began to see that more clearly, or did it just suddenly evolve that way?
You know, the funny answer is both. It began to evolve that way, and what happens, too, is that the book begins in a very kind of compressed way, in a very accelerated way. As you begin to get to know the characters a bit, it doesn't exactly slow down, but it stretches out a bit. And I think it's that part, as a writer and as a reader, that becomes, I don't know, that the best part, where you sort of sink into it. It's like when you're having a delicious dinner and you don't really want it to end. You think, oh, I'd like more of that macaroni and more of that steak and whatever. And it's somewhere in that part where it began to shift to being more about family and more about how Harry was going to build a family that he never had. I mean, I keep telling people, I think in some ways this is a midlife coming-of-age book, whatever that is. I've never heard of it before. I've never seen one. But to me, Harry is a guy who's just so stuck and so, in a way, imploded and impacted, sort of. He doesn't even know who he is. He's functional, but in a very uninspired sort of way. And then as he sort of has to step up to this responsibility of raising these two children and really figuring out an enormous amount about his life, his family, and, you know, those sort of hopes and dreams we have that we, in a way, abandon early on, and how he wants to kind of, you know, raise the bar a little bit for himself. You know, all I can say is it gets good and it gets interesting.
It seemed to me, reading those first pages, that granted, he made one terrible, terrible decision, which is the decision to sleep with his brother's wife. But that's the only really terrible decision he made. And after that, it's like Job. He's hit on the head time and time and time again until finally at page 150 to 200, looking at another 300 pages to go, I'm going, what now? He can't sink lower. And when you reach that point, where were you? I mean, were you just kind of one day walking around going, what the hell do I do now?
No, I mean, it's funny. It's a slow process for me. So I don't write necessarily that quickly. And I think there's things in it. Like there's a moment where he goes into an AA meeting and he tries to sort of participate and they kick him out because it's like he doesn't drink. You know, that's not his problem. But he needs some, you know, confirmation or ability to tell his story. For me, you know, fiction really comes out of the world we live in, and it really comes from, you know, not just reading the media, but sort of reading the culture. And, you know, there's a whole bit where he goes on this sort of internet bender of this sort of, you know, dating spree that also ends badly. And as I was writing that, and friends were saying to me, we don't think people really do that, do you? And I thought, yes, they do. And I read about this all the time, that people do this, and that split between who we are in our work lives and our family lives and who these sort of avataristic internet chat personas are, and people, you know, having horrible meetups with others and stuff. So I was really trying to kind of get into and under American culture and explore it from the inside out.
And in doing that, you create two very absurdist relationships with two different women, and yet, by the end of the book, neither relationship is absurd at all.
I think, isn't that contemporary life? I mean, isn't that where we are right now?
I don't know. I mean, there's another element, too, which I want to bring in, which is, of course, the element of Nixon and the wider culture, because a lot of this does have to do with the wider culture. Before I do that, let me ask you another question, because I've talked to a lot of writers about this. And some writers say, I had themes in mind. And other writers say, the only way I know about a theme is when I go on tour. What about you, A.M. Holmes?
I don't think I have specifically overt themes in mind. I think that I'm always trying to write things that are, you know, in that large sense about the world we're living in. In this case, I've gotten increasingly interested in that intersection of history and narrative and storytelling. And that's why Don DeLillo walks through the book a little bit. That's in part a little bit about why Nixon is in there. This isn't the first time I've done it. I wrote a short story a few years ago called The Former First Lady and the Football Hero that was all about Ron and Nancy Reagan. And, you know, the sense that I have that America maybe has Alzheimer's. So the contrasting of his presidency and his sort of fade to, you know, America in the larger sense. I guess I'm increasingly both philosophical and in a way political. And I think that I want to write fiction that sort of provokes us to think about that and to kind of, I don't know, own up to who we are in some way.
Harry's a professor of history, and he's teaching Nixon, which we'll go into in a moment, but he's let go because his boss in the university wants history to be forward-looking. In other words, don't look back. Obviously, I'm reminded of Gore Vidal's great statement, we live in the United States of amnesia, but you bring up the idea of America as having Alzheimer's.
The chair of the department tells him that history is now more future forward and we're not interested in the past. And I think that there is something in our culture that's very, very large where, you know, we don't in any way take notice of what has come before we decide what comes next. And that scares me. And I think we've seen it in the past several presidencies. I think we see it in our education system. I think we see it, you know, in a very global way in our planning for infrastructure. When Obama actually said that he was going to put stimulus money into infrastructure plans, it turned out there were no infrastructure plans because we've become a country that also runs on a campaign cycle and there are no long-term plans.
Why choose Nixon?
That's a very good question. Why choose Nixon? There's a couple reasons, and it, you know, one is as simple as I grew up in Washington, D.C., and Nixon was sort of the first president of my conscious life, and I grew up in a very liberal family, and we were perpetually marching on Washington, and my parents sort of threatened that we would move to Canada if he was elected for a second time. But also, I think, on a personal level, Nixon's presidency and the Watergate break-in and all of what sort of evolved from there also sort of dovetailed with my own kind of moral and social development, so that as I was becoming a teenager, I'm watching, you know, the world around me shift and watching adults scramble to respond to that. And being in Washington, it was a very particular kind of a strangeness. So there's that. And then importantly, you know, more than that, I think that everything from Nixon's idea that if the president does it, it's not illegal has certainly resonated through, you know, every presidency, certainly even probably before Nixon and after Nixon. And, you know, that particular presidency is one that's continuing to unfold. Materials that were seized when he left office, the White House special files, are still being released. And I think it's really, really quirky that this year Ann Beatty wrote a book called Mrs. Nixon. Tom Mallon wrote a book called Watergate. There's a new play opening in New York called Checkers about the Nixon's dog. And there's, you know, they keep restaging, you know, Nixon in China, Robert Wilson's, you know, sort of epic production. The other thread through it, too, is, you know, Nixon opened relations with China. That was 40 years ago, a little more than 40 years ago. China now owns more U.S. debt than any other country. Every phone we have, every piece of clothing we make, every toy I buy my kid is made in China. And yet we don't talk about that. Both in the culture, we don't talk about it in our literature. I find it fascinating.
Well, I see something else as well, which is that Nixon was the last of the non-telegenic presidents.
Absolutely.
He was the last president who was there because he was president, not because he gave a good speech.
Right. No, and, you know, I keep being brought back to this, too, because the Nixon-Kennedy debate, which some people may remember, was the first televised debate. People who saw it were sure Kennedy had won. Nixon sweated. He looked horrible. People who heard it thought Nixon won. But also the debate was so traumatic to the candidates, there was not another televised debate until Gerald Ford and Jimmy Carter. LBJ refused whatsoever. Nixon would never do it again. And I think that's interesting. It speaks to exactly what you're saying. There was a fundamental and has been a fundamental shift in the telegenicness and also the charisma of a certain kind needed to be president.
And yet at the same time, I get the sense in reading May We Be Forgiven that Nixon on some level is still emblematic of America.
I think absolutely, which is also, you know, a little bit terrifying. And I loved, you know, Nixon was a very odd guy, and he stayed up very late every night, and he wrote on long legal pads for hours and hours and hours, and that became the Nixon novels and short stories that appear in this book, which people keep saying, are they real? I'm like, no, that's not real. I made them up. But they are based on Nixon's life.
You did a lot of research. You went to the Nixon Library. What was that like?
I'd like to say it was wonderful. On my Facebook page, there's this great photo of a snow globe from Richard Nixon's birthplace. And I realized there's actually snow in it. And I thought, when did it snow in Yorba Linda? Which speaks again to the whole thing of, oh, my God, America is demented. But the Nixon Library was really interesting because part of it is you can actually request materials from those special files. So I got everything from a letter from William F. Buckley that says, you know, had dinner with Reagan the other night. His nose is out of joint. He thinks you don't call him often enough. And then there's a hand-scrawled note on it saying, you know, make note to call Reagan once a month. If I can't do it, have Bob do it, which I think was Haldeman. And then there's the phone records, which are in, you know, Rosemary Woods' handwriting. And it'll say, you know, 825, Dr. Kissinger, 901, Haldeman, 907, Haldeman, 908, Haldeman. And I'm not kidding. There'll be all these repeats. Then it'll say the Reverend Billy Graham, Julie in New York, which was his daughter in New York, BB, which is BB Rebozo, who wasn't even written out as a full name. I found the ephemera of the presidency just to be really, really interesting. And wonderful lines I came across, like George Meany had been the head of the AFL-CIO then. And there was a note from Nixon, when Mr. Meany calls, put him through. And then there's a little, because they didn't have digital things, and there was, you know, weren't exactly Post-its. Then there's a little piece of White House stationery that just says, Mr. Meany is on the line. And I love that somehow as a phrase, Mr. Meany is on the line, because it could mean anything. I mean, besides the phone, it could mean, you know, at risk.
As you're talking, I kept thinking that there's one other element of Nixon, which may be part of why we're drawn to it, which is, we're looking for a rosebud moment, and for most of the other politicians, we're not. But for Nixon, there's still that search for that key that will unlock whatever this strange man was.
Mm-hmm. I don't think we have any sense of it, honestly. And, you know, there's a book that I read as part of my research by his psychiatrist. There's a book by his doctor. I think he was a very, very, not just complicated, but a much darker psyche than, you know, most of us realize.
Yet he was also the last liberal president.
Well, isn't that fascinating? I mean, he started the Environmental Protection Agency. He did all kinds of things that, by comparison to what's out there now, you think, that's wonderful.
Well, we're talking here a little bit about the history of America. We've got Nixon and his era, and then, of course, we've got Reagan and his era, which is still reflected in the rantings of someone like Paul Ryan, mm-hmm. who grew up in that world.
Absolutely.
And then we've got 9/11,
mm-hmm.
and you were there in Manhattan. How do you think 9/11 influences, first of all, your novels, and also how you look at America through the prism of your novels?
Right. You know, I think it actually is an incredible shift for me in terms of the work, and here's a couple reasons why. I was home that day, and a friend called from St. Vincent's Hospital and said, look out your window, a plane just hit the World Trade Center, and at that point, they thought it was a small plane. And I looked out, and because of the view I had from where I lived at the time, I saw the second plane come in, and I saw it hit. And I stood there watching the whole thing unfold. And I actually photographed it because I didn't know what else to do to make sense of it. But that moment, for somebody who lives in their imagination and who is known to be the transgressive, dark writer with the dark imagination, what I saw in reality was something I never could have conjured. And it was terrifying because it meant that the world that I relied on to be a very stable place was suddenly no longer stable, which also meant that it's a very dangerous time to go into your imagination, because what are you going to come out and find? So there was a shift there, and part of that shift for me really was thinking a lot about our relationships to each other and how do we relate to each other and our responsibilities, not just to ourselves in the very American narcissistic way, but to our communities. And I think you begin to see that in my work in the last novel, This Book Will Save Your Life, which really is, again, in some ways similar to this one because it's about a guy who's worked so hard to earn a lot of money and be successful, but he has no life anymore. And it's about him learning to come back to life. And in May We Be Forgiven, it's a lot about learning to build families of choice, learning to pull people towards you, and how to interact in an extended community. So I'm not sure I'm answering the question directly, but all of that, and even the desire to write optimistically, which is not a literary tradition. In fact, seems to piss people off if you try to write it all optimistically. And it's harder to do. It's harder to write something that has an uplift to it or a sense of redemption than to just be, you know, goddamn depressing all the time.
As the novel expanded in different directions, the idea of faith and religion did take a role.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have any idea early on that it would?
Not as overtly as it did. I mean, I think the notion of faith or the belief or need for some kind of spiritual or communal life has been on my mind for the last, you know, several years. And in this book, there is a sort of, it's funny to say, I keep calling it a Jewish theme that I hadn't ever sort of risked exploring before. And I think it's interesting that in some ways I was afraid to do it because I thought, oh, no, this will be my Jewish book and people will be upset by that. But the secret and the truth is I'm incredibly happy about it because it's also, it's a little bit to me like that Coen Brothers movie, Serious Man. It's this Jewish theme, but it probably will be equally offensive to Jews because it's, you know, there's a rabbinical student named Ryan.
The Chinese woman?
Yes, there's the adult Chinese adoptee because the family didn't like the baby they were offered, so they took an adult instead who works at a synagogue. There's some kind of, you know, rollicking great stuff about that in there. And also the idea, and I have a problem with certain religions, where, and I actually had this happen in California. I was traveling one year for the Jewish holidays, and I am Jewish. Even though I'm half Catholic and half Jewish, I believe myself to be Jewish or Buish or Buddhist Jew, whatever, anyway. I tried to go to a temple for the Jewish holidays, and they said to me, you can't come. Basically, you don't have a ticket. You're not a member. And I said, but I'm a member of a temple in New York. They said, well, unless you can produce a letter showing us that, you can't come. And I thought, this is completely antithetical to everything I understand about the Jewish religion, that its notion of inclusion, you leave the door open for like Elijah, who's basically invisible to come in, but the New Yorker traveling, wandering writer is not allowed in. So I find all those same sorts of things that are about our contemporary culture fascinating and horrifying.
Is it possible some of these other little tales from the book are also right from your own life that way?
Little tales, but in the largest sense, it's fiction.
Can you give an example of another one?
No, I mean, there's just funny things from my own life where I remember, you know, being a kid and growing up in Washington and going actually when Pat Nixon welcomed the giant pandas to the National Zoo. And this funny thing of kind of growing up in public where they stick a television camera in your face. They say, what do you think about the giant pandas? And my comment was, they're not really very big because they're not giant. And then, you know, the funny layover of that to me was about 2 years later, they were filming All the President's Men around the corner. So we used to play hooky from school to go watch Dustin Hoffman and Robert Redford be Woodward and Bernstein. And then I played hooky to go to the opening of that film and again ended up like on, you know, local TV talking about that. And, of course, got busted for playing hooky from school.
As the book progresses, we also hit another progression, which is the progression of Harry from pure narcissism to a sense of community. And I guess if we want to look at a metaphor about the United States, that would be the optimism that we're moving away from narcissism?
I wish we were moving away from narcissism. I want to say it's the only hope we have. I mean, I think we are still incredibly narcissistic. And the thing that's interesting is that a lot of European countries, while also sort of in some ways increasingly narcissistic, still have a very firm attachment to place, to their own nationalism, and to the family. You know, and European families don't go far from home. And in this country, basically, you run as fast as you can from wherever you live across the country and set up shop in a new place. So, you know, I hope the optimism isn't entirely fictional, but it's I would say, if I was evaluating the country, I would put it in the needs improvement.
Well, I did notice in the book, A.M. Holmes, that there are many low points in the life of Harry, and yet he never really has money problems. And you set that up. Why did you decide to ensure that he didn't have those problems?
That's a very, very good question. And I'll answer it backward by saying that I keep thinking I would love to teach a course in the economics of fiction. Because whether looking at books usually from a review point of view or teaching young writers, we never talk about how is it this person is able to do these things, or how would it be different if they didn't have money. Anything from Jay McInerney's Bright Lights, Big City to, you know, the Brontes. In this particular book, it was a clear choice that I made because I felt like there was so many other things on the table. And there are families in the book that contrast that. In fact, there's a woman who says to Harry at one point, how could you have any problems? Basically, you're white, you have money, kind of, you know what, your problems are really insignificant compared to the rest. And I would still say in some ways I think that's not good enough. I would like to try to figure out how to write some fiction which talks more concretely about the impact of economics on our ability to take care of our families, on our ability actually to be happy in some ways.
You also have a very strange insane asylum for very wealthy people and a prison that reminds me more of the Hunger Games than anything else.
Yes, this is true. The insane asylum actually closes to become an executive conference facility. And I think in my mind it was modeled on a combination of Yaddo, which is this wonderful artist retreat in upstate New York, and then a stranger place called The Point, which is a hotel that's a Rockefeller family. It was their home on Lake Placid up in very far upstate New York. You know, historically there are those places, whether it's Silver Hill, McLean's, the elite mental hospital. And then I secretly love that he goes into the woodsman program where you're left out in the woods to eat government cheese from lockers.
The way you bring it in is that's where George, the brother, has to go when he's committed crimes. And it occurred to me that more than likely early on in the book, you figured George would play a bigger role, and he never really does.
I don't think that's true, that I figured he would play a bigger role. I mean, I knew, you know, that what his actions were was going to mean that he would have to kind of exit in some form, stage left. And I think, you know, certainly his impact and his existence continues to be a factor. But, you know, I wanted to focus on Harry and I wanted to focus on the children. And I could have brought George back in a bit earlier near the end. He does kind of come back in a way. It's a bit of choosing, I think.
And also he's the only character who doesn't change.
Right. He does not change. He's horrible. Let's just be honest.
The two children who are, I think, 11 and 12,
mm-hmm.
is that right? Yeah. They're awfully mature.
Well, you know, I think that that's it's a valid comment and a dash of criticism, which is valid. I think the thing that's interesting to me about them is that there is that way in which some children are more mature than their parents and more, in a way, knowing and more, I don't know, you know, active and committed in their lives. So I think that I knew that about them, and in a way I like them for that. And that they also remind me, not literally of like a Holden Caulfield, but of those young adults in literature that know too much.
A.M. Holmes, the title, May We Be Forgiven. Honestly, it put me off at first, and then I'm reading instead a slapstick comedy. Why did you choose the title, and also why did you choose to keep it?
You know, I don't have a straight answer for that. I think I was interested in what it means to forgive oneself, to not hold a grudge in a way. You know, I think it takes an enormous amount of energy to hold on to bitterness. And I am a bit of, I'm a Jewist, you know, I'm a Jewish Buddhist. And so I'm really constantly trying to feel like, how do we let go of things? How do we not let our future being completely tainted by the past, but also be cognizant of the past. So in part it came from that. It's interesting. You're the first person who said they were sort of put off by the title, which is fine. It's just interesting.
There's a couple of other things, and in fact in interviews you've talked about this, that fiction written by men and women is very different. Men tend to go with big themes and women tend to deal more with domestic life, and I'm sure you've gotten some criticism for that comment. But it did strike me in reading the book that it's one of the few books written by a woman that I would have thought was written by a man, even though that sounds sexist.
No, you know, I've had this problem my whole life. I write books that are kind of guy books, if there is such a thing. And I think it's funny because I'm a woman. I've done a good job putting up with that fact. But there is a difference in the literature and in the way the literature moves through the marketplace even. And I've always been loath to talk about it because I feel like I don't want to come across as, oh, she's a feminist and she writes like a man. And what is that all about? You know, traditionally, men have written the larger social themes. Women have written the domestic. Grace Paley used to say that women had always done men the favor of reading their work, and men had not returned the favor. I have mostly male fans, you know, and I like that. But it's interesting. Women are actually usually mad at me. And again, what's that about?
In reading the book, the book is written from a man's perspective, and it's good. It works, which is something that you don't usually get.
I know, but to me, that's always the highest compliment. Like in the last book, we got a blurb from Stephen King, and it wasn't that it was Stephen King. It was that it was a guy the same age as my narrator, and he bought it. You know, I think to me, as a fiction writer, as someone who makes this stuff up, there's nothing better than to feel like, wow, I can inhabit, you know, a body, a mind, an existence so different from mine, and have it work.
A.M. Holmes, you've done a lot of work for television, including working on the team that did The L Word. You're apparently working on a new pilot now, which you might want to talk about or not, depending. But before we get there, you did make a comment in an interview. You said, I've learned things about storytelling through that work that are surprising. What did you learn, and how does that apply to, in particular, May We Be Forgiven, which came after The L Word?
Well, there's no relationship between The L Word and May We Be Forgiven.
Except in the sense of storytelling.
You know, maybe. I mean, the thing that's interesting to me is I always wanted to make a TV show, which is why I worked on The L Word, because there's a catch-22. You're not allowed to make a TV show until you've made a TV show. And I found it interesting, and I liked it. And the funniest piece of it is my friends would say to me, what makes you think that you can go and write for TV? And my answer was, what makes you think I can have a job? Because the only job I'd had was in 1985 working at Random House for 1 year. And I thought, you think I can sit upright all day? So that was the first greatest discovery was I could sit upright all day. And I loved it. I loved being in a room with people just generating material. And TV is a much faster medium than writing novels. There is not that singular ownership of story. So, you know, if it doesn't work, it's not all my fault. And it's fun. It's very fast and fun. So there's that. In terms of storytelling, what is interesting is unlike a movie, which is a fairly tight frame and compressed, you know, you've got 90 minutes and you've got to get this much story out. Episodic TV can unfold over 5 years. And that is a lot like a novel. When you think about when you're selling it and you say, well, it's going to start here and it's going to end here. Many times in TV land, people can't tell you that because they're not novelists and they're not used to thinking, how could this possibly end 5 years from now? So that's been an asset for me. In terms of how it's changed my writing, the truth is every time I come back to doing my own work and writing fiction, I'm like dancing in the streets. I'm so incredibly liberated that I think I probably write better and I write in a way more deeply than I ever have before because I'm so grateful to not be in a format.
I was also thinking in terms of both dialogue and pacing.
Yeah. Well, you know, in terms of dialogue, for me, I started off as a playwright, and I started off really with my literary mentors being essentially Harold Pinter and Edward Albee. And what I know about writing, I know from their use of dialogue, which is, I always think of it as like double word score in Scrabble, that you're trying to say something without saying the exact thing, but you want it to have multiple meanings. So I work hard along those lines.
Well, speaking of Pinter, the comment about Pinter is that more is said in the pauses than in the words. How do you achieve that in a novel?
I think it's that thing of not saying, you know, God, I hate you. You're, you know, horrible. Instead, you're saying, like, you know, catch up. You know what I mean? It's that very compressed, like when in a Pinter play when they say, like, you know, how's your breakfast? Fine. How's this? Fine. You know, it's great. I love Pinter so much.
And when you're writing from the point of view of Harry, you can choose to say what Harry's thinking or not.
Right, absolutely.
What is this CBS pilot?
There is no CBS pilot for this year because I actually canceled this is the honest thing. I had to cancel my television deal because I'm going on book tour and I agreed to write a book for the Swiss philosopher Alain de Botton about a large-scale institution. And he picked six of us. Alexander Hammond went into the United Nations. Jeff Dyer went onto an aircraft carrier. And I went into New York Hospital. So I've been hunkered down doing things like watching brain surgery, like up close in the operating room, for the last probably 3 or 4 weeks. And talking to patients and doctors and administrators about how a hospital functions, what's going on in terms of a healthcare crisis, And that split between the fact that the people who work in a hospital daily, it's the mundane for them, and yet for the rest of us who come as patients, that incredible sense of anxiety and obviously just the enormous fear of death.
Do you think that's the reason for the huge gap between the way we are treated and the way we feel like we should be treated?
I think it's a part of it. I've worked with some of the doctors, and it's so interesting to see how actually well they treat people much of the time. But in being sort of like just a piece in the system, and when you're trying to move through a hospital, whether it's from an emergency room, through a surgery, to a this, it's horrible, and it's very sort of dehumanizing. So the question becomes, how do you make that a more, I don't know, what, comfortable process?
Do you think that that kind of research could find its way into a novel down the road?
I don't know. I mean, I've got to write a book about it that's got to be done by the end of the year, and it's...
A full book?
Yes, I have to write a full book about it.
So these aren't just pieces that he's collecting?
No, this is each of us is writing, you know, hopefully a fairly small book, a couple hundred pages, and with no guidance of what that is. So it's each person really thinking of what does this mean to me and how do I talk about it.
Do you bring in a lot of personal anecdotes or your own history into this?
That's a good question. I haven't started writing it yet. But I think, you know, I've always been very interested in medicine. If I wasn't a novelist and I wasn't going to be in the Rolling Stones, I would have wanted to be a doctor. I used to go to the National Medical Library when I was about 16 and spend the whole, like, evening in there just reading very bizarre medical books. I think that the practice of medicine is both an art and a craft, and that in our current system, there is room for almost none of that.
Well, bringing that together with May We Be Forgiven does bring up the area of how technology has mm-hmm. changed all our lives. You have a little bit of it in the book, particularly in South Africa when, well, this may be a little bit different, when Nate wants to build a well with the money that they've gotten, all they want are plasma TVs.
Yeah.
But in the sense that the disconnect between how people are living now and technology, both in a hospital mm-hmm. or in the context of May We Be Forgiven, what does that bode for the future, do you think?
Well, I think we're living in a very sort of tricky moment where, on the one hand, technology has kind of accelerated and moved at a sort of a warp speed past what we actually as people can process. And I think that you see it in creative work when it's like, you know, you ask an architect, well, can you draw me the drawing by tomorrow? Can you write me a novel by next year? Can you do these things all very quickly? And at the same time, we don't have a chance to process the emotional impact of that. And it goes into chatting online. It goes into, you know, I think the thing you're talking about with the South African village wanting a TV rather than a well also goes into the fact that this, the enormity of whatever this American dream and its, you know, warped stages, has spread. It's a global thing, and people want to participate in it, despite, you know, the dark side of it all. But I am interested in where we are in terms of the fact that everyone walks down the street looking at something, talking into something. We are not looking outward. We are not looking at each other anymore.
And what I'm seeing among younger people is the inability to communicate face-to-face, even though when they get on their little machine, they're fine.
Right, absolutely.
And that's bizarre.
Yeah. I see people actually, lately I've seen people on dates, two people sitting next to each other, each on their thingies, their iPhones, their iPads. It's amazing to me.
And it takes them out of the moment, which takes all of us out of the moment.
Absolutely.
A.M. Holmes says, any interest from Hollywood on May We Be Forgiven?
We're working on that. I think it's funny that Hollywood looks at it and thinks, oh, it's a big book. It's a lot of story. We don't know how to do that now. But we'll see.
The thing about big novels these days, as you said, is that there is a new option out there.
Yes, the television option, and that remains an open option for this book. I think the interesting thing is, you know, they tried to do the corrections, Jonathan Franzen's book at HBO, and they shot the pilot, and they really weren't happy with what they got. I think the sense was that it was too grim.
A.M. Holmes, you're working on this nonfiction book. Have you started thinking about your next novel?
I haven't really. I'm going to write a book of short stories, which I've already started writing. So I'm going to finish that. My head needs to air out a little bit before I dive right into the next thing. And I really have to come out and look around a bit and see what's going on. And then I'll figure it out.
You've been listening to an interview with A.M. Holmes, whose latest novel is May We Be Forgiven. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves.